This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer Kurt Vonnegut, whose novels include Cat's Cradle, Slaughterhouse-Five, The Sirens of Titan, Breakfast of Champions, Deadeye Dick, and his latest, Galapagos. Vonnegut is in many ways a paradoxical writer. He writes comic novels about despair, and he's an atheist who's obsessed with all the questions about life that religion responds to. Vonnegut was born in 1922 in Indianapolis. He studied science in college, but after the atom bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, Vonnegut lost his faith in science. The potential dangers of new scientific breakthroughs and high-tech innovations have remained recurring themes of his books. Although he's described his novels as no more dangerous than a banana split, Vonnegut's books have been banned from many schools and taken off the shelves of several libraries. He opposes all forms of censorship, and as an officer of PEN, the International Writers Organization, he's an outspoken defender of free speech in America and abroad. Vonnegut's most frequently banned book is Slaughterhouse-Five, which is also the book that established him as a serious writer. The novel is based on his World War II experiences as a prisoner of war in Dresden, Germany, during the bombing of the city. He told me how he survived the bombing and the firestorms in Dresden.
Well, it was merely a matter of luck, as there were no air raid shelters in Dresden because an air raid was not expected. The Germans had believed it to be an open city. There, in fact, is no convention in war. I guess there wasn't medieval times, but they did not expect an attack, and there didn't seem to be any strong reason to attack it, so there were no air raid shelters. And it's a beautiful city like Vienna or Budapest. Or Prague, and one night, as the British came over, they're the ones who did the firebombing, really. The Americans dropped the high explosives. But the whole city was burned down, and all there was to hide in was cellars. And we happened to be quartered. Our work crew of American prisoners of war was quartered in a slaughterhouse. One thing, there weren't many buildings around. There were just a few large buildings. So the firestorm wasn't very intense there. Also, we were in a meat locker way under the street, so it would have been the place for Hitler to be, anybody to be. It was the safest place in Dresden, accidentally. So that's how I survived.
And then when the bombing was over, you had to go upstairs and dig out corpses.
Well, what we did first was the city had to cool off before we could walk around. I mean, it was like a volcano or something like that. You had to wait for the lava to cool off. But we stayed down for quite a while, I forget how long, and finally came back up. And then we had to walk and walk and walk until we could find someplace else to stay. There was nobody to lead us. I mean, we just had guards who were corporals and privates and sergeants, and they didn't know where the hell to go, and there was nobody for them to ask. So they marched us out on the edge of town and found us a place to stay out there. But then the city began to get organized, what was left of it and all that, and we were organized into work crews to go in and dig bodies out from underneath the street. And I have looked at movies of the liberation of concentration camps in Germany, where the SS was made to carry the corpses to the lime pits or to the graves or whatever, while a whole lot of people watched. And the moral situation isn't analogous at all, but the political situation is I have carried corpses while civilians watched. And thought it served me right to be carrying corpses.
What do you mean?
Because I was an American, and the corpses had been created by Americans and British.
It's a really odd situation for you, because you were being held prisoner by Germans, and mm-hmm. your ancestry is German.
Yeah.
And then you narrowly survived bombing by bombers from your own country.
Yeah.
So you were connected and really attacked by
oh, yeah.
your own people
well,
on both
I've been,
sides.
I've been attacked by the Russians. I was captured by the Russians after the war. and they held us prisoner for a while until they could exchange us one for one for Russians that the Americans had.
Did the bombing and the stench of the bodies that you were digging up afterwards haunt you? Did those memories
no,
haunt you for years?
No, if you were imagining it, is yes, of course it would, and that would, and so the person would be colored for the rest of his life by this stench in his nostrils and all that. This was a wonderful teenage adventure in my life. I wouldn't have missed a moment of it. It did not wound me at all. Things that happened when I was 6 years old will go a whole lot. We'll explain far more thoroughly what I am than Dresden. No, it was a great adventure. I loved the whole damn thing.
You really did.
Oh yeah, and I liked being in the infantry. I wouldn't have missed it.
I'm just so surprised to hear that.
Well, it's wrong for a pacifist to like war that much, but I found nothing to object to.
I guess it's part of being young.
Yeah.
For you. When did you realize you were going to write about it? Was it then or years later?
I felt that it just kept nagging at me. It took me a while to realize that this was an important historical event, and it turns out to have been the largest massacre in European history. Now, massacre is something that happened suddenly, as heaven knows that Auschwitz killed many, many more people, but slowly, you know, in an industrial manner, and in just one big whoosh of killing a whole lot of people suddenly, Dresden held the record, and I had been there. And so I decided, I'd better write about this, because I was a professional writer, and I was always casting about for what to write about next. It took me a long time to do.
Did the writing about it change the way you remembered it? Did it bring back memories that you hadn't remembered, you know, things that you hadn't remembered? Or did you see it through a different filter because you were older then and had experienced more?
Well, I wrote, well, for one thing, I had one of the filters I'd seen it through was war movies about World War II and war books. And, of course, they featured Frank Sinatra and Duke Wayne and all that. And it took me a long time to realize that this war was, in fact, fought by children, you know, and not these middle-aged 4F movie actors. And so that's what one thing made the book bizarre, that, in fact, the infantrymen were teenagers, which is not usual in an American war story.
You've joked that you're not only one of the few survivors of that bombing, but you're the only person to have made a profit from it, because through royalties for your book, you've made about $3 per person killed in Dresden. And I was wondering if you had ever experienced what's sometimes called survivor's guilt.
Probably in some other situations, not the Dresden situation. I did lose several friends. There were 100 of us in that prisoner of war camp, a little labor gang in Dresden, and 5% of us died, didn't make it back home for one reason or another. That's not enough to give you survivor's guilt, I guess. I will issue the challenge again here, because the a lot of people get mad at me for having talked about the destruction of a Nazi city, you know, and I saw it, which is the reason I wrote about it, and there's no reason for me to keep it secret that I saw it. But another thing is that absolutely nothing was gained by it, and I'll issue the challenge again here, that nobody in this whole world benefited from that air raid but me. That not one person got out of Auschwitz a microsecond earlier, not one German soldier fell back from his foxhole on the Russian front or the American front. Nothing was changed at all, and that I'm the only person who benefited, and I got $3 and maybe $4 for each person killed there, and so this is going out over radio. I've done it on BBC and so forth, and that first letter has yet to float in. It's, hey, if it weren't for Dresden, whatever.
The book that was based in part on your experience, The Slaughterhouse Five, was also made into a movie. Were you happy with the adaptation?
Oh, I loved it. And I've often said that Margaret Mitchell and I ought to be crazy about Hollywood. Probably nobody else should be. But most satisfactory movies is mine and Gone with the Wind.
My guest is writer Kurt Vonnegut. You've referred to yourself as part of the last generation of full-time novelists. What do you mean?
Well, 1922 is a key year, and for one reason or another, there are a lot of fairly well-known writers clustered around that date. It'd be James Jones, it'd be Bill Styron, it'd be myself, and Mailer. As I think it's all 1920, 21, 22, 23 in there, and then by slight extension we pick up Updike and Vidal and so forth. And we were all able to get a start in this business because there was a booming magazine industry then. I supported myself. I quit General Electric and became a full-time freelance because of magazines. Paid so well. I paid so much better than General Electric. And so I was able to give myself my own MacArthur genius grant, you know, or my own Guggenheim, writing short stories for Collier's or Saturday Evening Post. And all those writers I've named, I'm sure they went broke at one time or another, needed money in a hurry, and wrote a short story and mailed it off and got a respectable amount of money back. Money-raising scheme no longer exists for writers. It's television that killed it, and ad agencies found, truthfully, that television was a much better buy for their clients than magazines. There was nothing malicious in it. But the magazines failed, and you can't mail a thing off to a TV station and expect them to buy it and send you money back. So the magazine industry used to finance us, and there is no such industry now.
So you think because of the economics of writing that it's very difficult for writers to be full-time novelists?
And one consequence is that your novelists, as you will have them, are people who are rich or have married rich. And so you are going to get more and more stories about Andover and Brown and Harvard and so forth, and these lives certainly deserve to be reported on. But I think you're going to have an upper-class literature because only the upper classes will be able to afford the time it takes to write a novel.
You've seen other changes in the publishing industry too, and one of those changes is the things that an author has to do to sell a book, because unless you have a bestseller now, I think a lot of people in publishing could care less.
Well, that's all they want to publish now, in many cases. That's all they're interested in, is these people from business schools have come up with this wonderful idea. Hey, why don't you publish nothing but bestsellers, you know, is why waste money on anything else? And so some extremely good writers in this country are having trouble finding publishers now because they only sell 25,000, 30,000 copies, which is nothing anymore.
What was your big break as a writer?
I've always done well. And my big break was that the magazines existed. And I never intended to make a heck of a lot of money. Doing well, I've always done as well as I would have if I had been a principal of a junior high school, for instance. Well, we have a nice car, and I have nice suits and snow suits for the kids and all that. So I've always done that well. And the critical breakthrough was Slaughterhouse-Five, as people finally decided I was a serious writer. And, I mean, it was the New York Times who said I was okay. Up to that time, my books weren't reviewed at all, or just in a list in the back of the New York Times book review is also received and noted or whatever, in a little paraphrase of the content of each book, supposedly. But it was Slaughterhouse-Five, and that was my fifth or sixth novel. But I'd written good books before that, and they're all in print now. I'm totally in print. And in 1965, I was totally out of print, and now I'm totally in print.
In the 1960s and early 70s, I think you were enormously popular on college campuses.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you felt about that, and if you felt the same kind of common bond with your readers that they felt toward you at that time.
No, because I didn't really show myself to my people. I would go on the peace marches, but I would just be part of a throng wherever it was, and I didn't lecture at all. I lecture a good deal now. I never appeared on campuses in those days, so people never met me and never saw me and probably didn't know what I looked like. My only representatives were my books, which is fine, as I would just as soon were that way today.
As popular as your books are, they've also been banned by some school libraries, by some regular libraries. How do you usually find out about it? What do they tell you? And do you find out directly from the person who banned the book when it's banned?
No. You pick it up from newspapers, or you hear talk or whatever. You have to chase down cases of censorship. And, of course, it's a huge country. My publisher and I have an agreement that whenever we hear of such a case, that our primary interest is in offering help to the librarian or the teacher who has gotten into trouble as a result of recommending a book by me. And we also tell the ACLU, I can't think of a case that we've reported to the ACLU that they didn't already know, because they have chapters all over the country, and I have no such spy system out. So it's catch as catch can as I hear about it. There's no reason for me ever to testify in court, and so I'm not a participant in any censorship case.
Can you describe some of the passages in your book that are responsible for them being banned?
No, neither can the book banners, as they customarily haven't read them. And these are nice people. They're usually not very well educated. They have kids. They want to help the community in some way. They run for the school committee. And so suddenly, for the first time in their lives, they are dealing with books since high school or whatever. And so they are over their heads. But there are organizations which will give them lists of bad books, which they don't even have to read. Are these books on your shelves? And so they will go, and indeed some of them are. There's an awful lot of them are out of print. There's apparently the basic list, which includes Slaughterhouse-Five. It also includes Deliverance and Catcher in the Rye. Apparently it was circulated. It's just Xerox now. It was apparently circulated by 1971, because no book on it was published after that time. A lot of the books on that list are out of print now, as they're so unpopular. I get letters from the Soviet Union. I'm published over there. I get letters of sympathy saying that they're so sorry my books are being burned over here, and that they want me to know that my books will always be available over there. Obviously, in the Soviet Union, they've made a great deal of the very minor and rare cases of censorship in this country. I think what's new is not the censorship, but the opposition to censorship. As I think for 200 years, people have been perfectly free to censor school libraries, public libraries. Nobody's opposed them. And what is new is that suddenly they're being opposed.
You've been active in an international movement to defend the intellectual freedom of writers and other people, and you're an officer of PEN, the writers' organization. You recently went on a trip to several Eastern European countries. What were you looking for there?
Well, we simply wanted to know how the writers were there and to tell them, hey, we're thinking about you, you haven't been forgotten, because the situation in Poland and in East Germany and in Czechoslovakia is quite pathetic. And activist, I guess maybe I'm an activist, but it's a futile activity. There's really very little pressure we can bring on a Warsaw Pact government. Now and then it works, as we have from time to time gotten a person sprung from jail, and our few successes make it worthwhile to keep trying. But there are a whole lot of writers we'll never even hear about who are in Siberia or whatever. It's worth a try, and our successes aren't numerous.
My guest is Kurt Vonnegut. You've taught writing, and you've taught it over a period of several years. Yet, when you were young and first starting to write, you'd never been a student of writing or been a student of literature as your major in college, do you think that that hurt or helped you in any way? Because you were a major in science, not in literature or writing.
No, if I had met someone like myself, I would have felt a lot more confident about becoming a writer, and I also would have known a lot, almost everything I found out about writing. I learned the hard way, whereas, in fact, it was all in Aristotle's Poetics. Now, there are a few fundamental things that are known about storytelling, simply because some stories have succeeded and others have failed. So I can be like a golf pro, is I can stand to one side and tell you to swing your club, and I'll say, all right, put a little more weight on your left foot, is move your thumb down a quarter of an inch, and the ball will go 50 feet farther. And you won't yourself know what the hell you were doing wrong. And there are things you can do wrong in storytelling. I mean, these are mechanical things. So I can be helpful in that way.
Because you weren't studying literature and because you didn't have teachers criticizing your writing, was writing more fun to you when you were younger than it
and
might have been if you were a serious student of
reading,
it?
Reading was a lot more fun, too. I've never done. I've always read for pleasure, and I've never had to explain afterwards what the author had done to prove that I had understood the book at all. And when I enter into literary conversations now, I don't have the vocabulary. I don't have the critical approach that most people who have come through seminars and all that. So I really can't speak literature very well.
Do you wish that you could?
No, because I think in my case it would be crippling. And I've said that English writers will come out of almost any department but the English department. And this is not to insult English departments. When I say this in a lecture, everybody says, oh, yeah, hoo-hoo, what a bunch of jerks in the English department. Well, it's not the purpose of an English department to turn out creative writers. It's to turn out literary historians, cultivated people, and people who will in turn teach people the wonders of their language and their literature. And but one thing an English department will do will teach you good taste too soon. And so when you can't write very well but are starting out, you will be horrified when you compare yourself with James Joyce at the peak of his powers or Proust or Mark Twain or whatever. And so when I was in the chemistry department at Cornell, writing for the Cornell Sun, I thought everything was wonderful, and I thought what I was doing, you know, I didn't know any better, so I dared to begin.
Well, your first writing in print, I think, was for first your high school.
Yeah, high school
newspaper.
And I went to a high school that had a daily paper, and then when I went to Cornell, I'd already been getting out a daily paper, so I had no trouble getting on the Cornell Sun when I was there.
Were you reporting?
For the Sun? Well, I finally wound up as managing editor, but I was at Cornell for 3 years until I went to war. But after the war, I became a police reporter in Chicago at the same time I was going to the University of Chicago.
Do you think that helped you, trying to describe things in simple sentences as you saw it?
Well, it's the fault of my style, certainly. A lot of critics find it too simple, and the newspaper style has always seemed to me wonderfully honest, is you tell as much as you know as quickly as you can. And actually, all my books, I start out with saying what the book's about and how it's going to end on the first page and then get on with it. And I don't hold things in suspense, and I don't hide surprises along the way, because newspaper people don't do that.
I guess what you said is really true, because a lot of your books actually have introductions in which you explain what's going to happen in the book before you actually get to the body of the book.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's the pleasure in a play, usually, is knowing what is going to come. Is a really successful play is so loaded with hints about what the third act is about that you're just thrilled by the third act when it all comes to.
Do you still read a lot for pleasure?
Well, I read a lot for social reasons now. I think people are really influenced by novels from between the age of 12 and 24, say. And whatever I am today, whatever my literary tastes are, whatever authors I admire, what my politics are largely determined by books I read back then. That was a long time ago. Since then, I have read books for information or to prove to myself and to others that I'm an educated person. And living in New York, I know a heck of a lot of writers. And so I will read books because I know I'm going to meet this person very soon, and I don't want to lie to the person.
Well, you know, it's almost a reason for not reading the book, because the other way of looking at it is you read the book, say you don't like it, mm-hmm. you run into this writer who you'd like to think of as a friend, and you don't really want to insult them, and so what are you going to do, tell them the truth? And so I don't know how you handle that.
Oh, well, you lie if you want to. I mean, there are certain prices you pay for living in New York. You're not truthful in your opinions of paintings or music or anything else. Your mate will know what you really think, but your friends won't, because the friendships matter.
I hesitate to ask you this, but do you have any books of yours that are, to you, representative of your best work? Are there ones that you are...
Oh, well, there are ones I'm particularly fond of, sure. I've graded them one time. I gave grades to all my books, and it was just how I felt that day about each book. But I'm very pleased with my career. Here I am, 64 years old, or 62, and I never expected to write this many books and to be satisfied to the extent I am with them. Because my grades weren't particularly good in school, and prognosis did not seem good. So I'm proud to have finished the book.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us.
Well, pleasure.
My guest has been writer Kurt Vonnegut. He later told me his favorites of his books are The Sirens of Titan, Deadeye Dick, and his latest, Galapagos. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Jay Goldman and Ron Barron. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.